three.
Hello and welcome to the Health and Happiness Show on Untangled FM. I'm Edwina Griffin. I hope you've all had a great week recording your meditation diaries and practicing gratitude after our chat with Amanda Rossetti last week. We've discussed various elements that might contribute to health and happiness on the show so far, including nutrition, mindfulness, stress management, social change and sustainable living, and spiritual practice. Today we're going to speak to an expert and pioneer in enhancing happiness. He has 3 degrees in psychology, including a PhD, an impressive record as an academic, clinician and coach. He runs one of Sydney's most respected clinical psychology practices. He's a highly regarded executive coaching practice and is the founder and CHO, Chief Happiness Officer, of the Happiness Institute, Australia's first and now largest organisation devoted solely to enhancing happiness in individuals, families and organisations. He's taught at all the major universities in New South Wales and is currently an adjunct professor in positive psychology within the School of Management Faculty of Business at UTS and also an adjunct professor within the School of Health Sciences at RMIT University. In 2008, his achievements were recognised by the Australian Davos Connection when he received a Future Leadership Award. He's also a best-selling author with books such as The Happiness Handbook, 100 Ways to Happiness, A Guide for Busy People, and most recently, 100 Ways to Happy Children, A Guide for Busy Parents. I'm very excited to welcome Dr. Timothy Sharp on the show. Welcome, Dr. Sharp.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's great to have you here. Now, there's been a big shift in society in general in the Western world towards this search for happiness, with happiness conferences coming up and expansions of organisations such as your Happiness Institute. Do you believe, is society becoming less happy than it was 20 years ago, or is it that our values are shifting, or why do you think this is the case?
Well, no, I don't think the interest in happiness and positive psychology is necessarily due to us becoming any unhappier. In fact, I think people have been searching for happiness for millennia, for hundreds of thousands of years, in various ways, shapes and forms. They might have used a different language over the years, but if you look back through all the great philosophical and religious texts and historical texts, man has always been searching for the meaning of life and happiness in some form or other. So I think what we're seeing at the moment is just a continuation of that search, combined with what is relatively new, and that's the science behind it. So the science of positive psychology, which is relatively new, it's just maybe 15 years old, has started to, allow us to look at it in a different way, slightly more scientific way and a more practical way as well. So what we're seeing now is not just gurus espousing great ideas, but we're seeing scientists providing some credible, valid and reliable evidence for what really makes happiness, what we can all do to boost our happiness and how we can enhance it in our lives, in our workplaces and in our schools. So I think it's a combination of all of those things coming together.
Right, fantastic. So you have many programs, obviously, which are based on extensive research in the area of happiness. Can you outline some of the research that's influenced the programs you've created?
Yeah, sure. So one of the most significant influences has been Martin Seligman, who's probably the most famous positive psychologist, or is often considered the grandfather or godfather of positive psychology. But he, along with another, there was a group of first-generation positive psychologists, Martin Seligman, Chris Peterson, Ed Diener, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. These are some researchers who were building up their database sort of 15, 20 years ago. And they were my first and biggest influences, and they conducted their research around optimism and hope, building on strengths, and virtues, understanding virtues and values. These sorts of research projects led to the development of what we offer at the Happiness Institute, which are practical programs. We conduct a bit of research ourselves where we primarily focus on distilling the information, taking what the academics and researchers find and repackaging it up into something that the everyday man, the man on the street, can understand and put into practice. What we're now seeing is a second generation of younger researchers who are doing some really exciting stuff, and they've taken the original findings. So the basic principles actually haven't changed that much, but what we're doing now is seeing a refinement so that we're getting much more specific in terms of our understanding of principles like like meaning and purpose and optimism and strength and building positive relationships, and also much more specific in terms of how they can and should be applied by different people at different times. So it's a really exciting field to be in. It's a really exciting time within the field. And we're also seeing the applications being applied in all sorts of different areas. So it's in the personal development field, but also in workplaces. So there's a parallel study or area of study to positive psychology called positive organizational scholarship, which is the application of this to organizational and business contexts. We're seeing a lot of exciting action happening in the education space, and there's a movement called Positive Education. Yesterday, actually, afternoon, I just spoke to about 300 teachers from a bunch of Sydney schools, looking at how to apply this within an educational context. And we're also seeing it applied in the health arena. So we have one of our newest and most exciting programs is called the Happiness Diet, which is, in very simple terms, the application of positive principles, positive psychology principles to weight loss and healthy eating. So, our focus is mainly on taking the research, translating it into language that everyone can understand, and particularly translating it into practical strategies that that you, me, and anyone can apply today and tomorrow to live a better life.
Fantastic. Well, there's so much info there that I want to ask you about now. So I realize you have, like you're saying, you're running programs in all different areas. Like, how would it differ in terms of, you're doing happiness in the workplace, say? Is finding personal happiness enough to sustain a happy workplace? Or, is the approach to happiness very different in that environment?
Well, no, the approach is not different at all, because the workplace is really just a collection of individuals. So the basic principles really don't vary. I mean, kids in school are people, teachers are people, employees and employers and managers and executives are people. So the basic principles, what goes to make for a happy life, are pretty much the same, and they're the things that I've touched on. So it's about clarifying your life purpose and direction and goals. It's about healthy living, sleeping well and exercising and eating, good nutritious diet. It's about approaching life with hope and optimism. It's about connecting with others, because, happiness isn't the same as selfishness. Positive relationships are very important. And it's about appreciation and gratitude and fun. So all of these principles are the same, pretty much the same in all areas of our life. What differs is the language that we use in those different contexts and some of the specific applications. So when I'm talking to a bunch of business leaders, senior executives, for example, I would use slightly different language, and we would use different examples than I would use maybe if I'm talking to some school children or even teachers or just a general public audience. But this is something we all, this is something that cuts through everything that we do, that every individual is different, regardless of their title or age or gender even. And so what we typically do is present the principles in an appropriate way given that audience. But then we invite our audience, whoever they are, to think about, and this is our challenge in life, to think about, how does this apply for me as an individual, given my context and my circumstances? So, and the answers to that might vary. So the answers for me will vary depending on whether I'm thinking of myself as a coach and psychologist, or whether I think of myself as a husband or father, or whether I think of myself as a friend. And the way I apply those principles will vary slightly in different parts of my life. And this is what we encourage people to do, to firstly learn and understand the basic principles, and then think about, how can they apply them in the workplace? How do they apply them when they get home? And there'll be a bit of overlap there, but there'll also be some subtle differences. And this is what the happiest people do well. They don't just understand the principles, they do, but they also tweak them and tailor them for the different parts of their life and different times of their life.
Right, yeah, that makes sense. And in your opinion, do people's expectation for happiness often set us up for unhappiness, in terms of, that we expect we should always be happy? I mean, there's an argument that, periods of reflection and depression are sometimes needed, the dark nights of the soul, sometimes referred to as, that offer an opportunity for us to evolve and grow. And what's your opinion about that? Are we meant to be happy all the time?
No, very definitely not. And that's a very, very good point. And yes, expectations are vitally important, because if as you've suggested, people expect to be happy every minute of every day, then they're going to be disappointed. That's just totally, it's an impossible goal. It's unrealistic. It's not natural. It's not normal. So this is a very important message, one that I'm constantly espousing and encouraging people to reflect upon. You know, it is totally normal and appropriate, as you suggested, to experience anxiety, to experience frustration, to experience some sadness, you know, after a loss. These are normal human emotions. I mean, people that didn't, if there's anyone out there who doesn't experience any of those negative emotions, sadness, depression, anxiety, frustration, then there's something wrong with them. So yes, we do need to be realistic, and the reality is we won't be happy every minute of every day. We need to accept that those emotions are perfectly normal. In fact, you know, and they're understandable. In fact, they can be quite helpful. We can learn from them. We can grow from them. They can contribute to maturity and wisdom. But we obviously don't want them to go on for too long. So positive psychology is not saying you should be happy every minute of every day. It's saying we want to be happy as much as we can. But when we do experience distress, we want to understand it, learn from it, and then bounce back as quickly as possible. Now that will depend on the nature of the distress. If you've, you know, if you've lost a loved one, that could take months and months, possibly years. So there's no, you know, specific time frame. It depends on the nature of the, you know, the trigger or the trauma. But as soon as we can, as soon as it's realistic and reasonable, we want to bounce back and live our best lives as often as we can.
And how do you see, you know, in traditional societies, you know, through ancient times, of the role of sort of ritual and ceremony in kind of seeing people through hard time, and, you know, almost an initiation into the next phase, and, you know, a lot of ceremony and ritual seems to have gone from society today. How do you see that in terms of assisting a shift or not, or what's your opinion on that?
Yeah, look, at another very interesting question, and, you know, there are many, well, one of the areas that the positive psychologists have looked at is religion, obviously, religion and spirituality. In very simple terms, and it's not a simple issue, in fact, it's a very complex issue, as I'm sure you can imagine, but in very simple terms, those people that have broadly defined religious or spiritual beliefs tend to be happier. Now, the question we then ask is why? Is it actually a belief in God or some higher power? And that may have some role. But what's almost certainly part of it is what you've touched upon, the rituals and ceremonies that go along with religion and spiritual beliefs. And there are certainly many psychologists who believe that the loss of that has been a significant loss, that we've, even if we don't have religious or spiritual beliefs, we would benefit from having some of those rituals and ceremonies in our lives. And I recently read a very interesting book, not by a positive psychologist, but by a philosopher, who some of your listeners may have heard of, Alain de Botton, and he recently published a book called Religion for Atheists. And he's an atheist, so he argues he doesn't believe in a higher power or God. But what he does argue is that there are lots of benefits that religions hold, and that we shouldn't necessarily throw out the baby with the bathwater. And he's arguing, and I think this is it's a very interesting and valid argument, that if we can take the best of religion, well, if you're not a religious person, if you are, then that's fine. But if you're not a religious person, if we take the best out of it, some of those rituals, some of the connectedness, that sense of belonging, and apply that in other ways without necessarily the belief, if you don't want to have that belief, then we can still gain a lot from that. And I think in some sort of different ways, that's what positive psychology is doing. It's not definitely not offering itself up as a religion in any way, and it definitely doesn't, you know, it's not throwing up any gurus or prophets. But what positive psychology is trying to do is construct, not just help individuals live their best life, but construct positive institutions. Our schools, our universities, our governments, positive institutions that support and reinforce healthy and happiness-inducing behaviours, so we can all benefit.
Yeah, fantastic. And I see you've set up happiness clubs throughout Australia. How exactly do they work, and is that an international program or trend? Or, I mean, you're saying that the institutions are developing more and more. What do your happiness clubs do, and how do they work?
Oh, we have there's a couple of different options that we provide and support. We have our own network of of coaches and facilitators around Australia, and we're possibly looking at expanding that around the world. So these are people that these are qualified people that have appropriate qualifications in psychology or coaching or something similar, and they I guess we grant them the right to provide our programs, to use our programs and resources in their work. So that's the main thing we offer. We have our own team that does that, but we also have this network who deliver a range of programs all around Australia. But we also have supported these happiness clubs, which is actually an idea we borrowed from someone in America, Lionel Ketchian, who set this up. And we've been communicating with him for a couple of years now. And we really just, with his permission, obviously, have borrowed and borrowed some of his ideas. And that's just that. So this is a totally free version of some of the things we do, and so anyone, any amateur, can get in touch, and we provide them with a bit of basic support and a bit of basic resources. And the idea is that they can just go out and set up happiness clubs and do whatever they think might be useful in their local community. So often what they do is just they'll meet once a month with they'll spread the word through their local newspapers or communities, and they'll meet once a month and discuss issues around positive psychology, and we allow them access to some of our resources. And we produce a weekly newsletter, a free newsletter, and we have a whole bunch of tip sheets on our website. And often they'll just use them as starting points for conversation. Maybe one of my recent blog articles, they might pick up on that, and they'll just read through that and then start talking about it. And it's just really a simple idea. It's very accessible. It costs nothing. People they don't charge for it. And it's just a way of getting people thinking about and talking about positive principles, and hopefully things that they can take back into their life to live better lives.
Fantastic. And what about with your approach for achieving happiness? In recent years, that I've become more aware of anyway in the last 10 years, there's been a lot more research into neuroplasticity and, the ability for us to reprogram our brain. And has that shifted, I guess, the goalposts for achieving higher levels of happiness?
It's one of the most fascinating areas, as I'm sure you've obviously heard about it and read about it, and I'm sure some of your listeners have. And what it's done is fundamentally change what we believe is possible. I think in years gone by, although there were psychologists and coaches and various health professionals who knew that we could, have a positive impact on people's lives, I think many people in decades past probably limited their expectations because they thought the brain was, particularly the brain, but also the way that our genes express themselves. We kind of thought, you're born with something and that's pretty much all you've got. And in fact, when it came to the brain, we thought that it reached sort of peak maturity, got to its best in the sort of maybe mid to late 20s. And then it was pretty much all downhill from there. That's what we used to think. And that's why people thought, as you aged, your memory started to suffer, it was harder to learn things. Now, some of that is true, but what we've seen, as you've hinted at, what we've seen in recent years is this idea of neuroplasticity, that the brain can still grow and learn and form new connections. It can still change. In fact, it does change as we age, well into our older years. And that combined with some other research, which is looking at gene expression, is fascinating. And what it's led to us believing now is that we can actually achieve far more than we probably thought we could. We can be much happier despite our genetic background, so to speak, because we know that a certain amount of happiness is determined by our genetic makeup. But what we've thought up until recently is that that was pretty much set in concrete. What we now know is that although the genes certainly do make a contribution, the way they express themselves does change depending on how we live our lives. So if we live a healthy, happy life, if we live a positive life, if we build positive relationships and engage in optimistic thinking, then those genes will actually express themselves in a different way. And I guess, again, without sort of boring your listeners with some of the specific details, what the most important finding from that is that we can actually have much greater lives than we probably thought were possible, and that can come from living a good life. Now, that sort of sounds like a circular argument, but the more good things we do, the more good things we'll experience. Positivity breeds positivity, and that's really exciting. I mean, anyone who chooses to do the right sorts of things, positive, healthy behaviours, can live a great life. No, it doesn't mean it'd be a perfect life. Bad things will still happen. We still need to deal with them. But I think the possibilities have been expanded by some of this recent exciting research.
Yeah, it's really exciting. Now, what about, so you're saying positivity breeds positivity. What about when someone is in a space of, there's a lot of people under a lot of stress in the current economic climate, or if someone's been through a traumatic time, do you have any tips that you give people for shifting out of that space sort of quickly to, really change the patterns of behaviour if someone's had, say, a series of trauma or a pattern of, say, negative behaviour? What is your approach to then sort of switching into this new mode of being? Are there any tips you can give?
Yeah, my background's actually in clinical psychology, so that means I specialised in misery before I discovered happiness. So I spent the first half of my career helping people overcome some really difficult situations, and I still wear that hat sometimes. I still have a clinical psychology practice, and we treat people with depression and stress, and people who are confronted by all sorts of sometimes quite significant forms of adversity and challenges. So I'll preface my response by saying, look, it obviously varies depending on the person and the nature of their stressor. So I can give a few general answers, but those people that are really struggling would clearly I'd recommend they see a professional so that they get an individualised, tailored response to, because we are all different, but there are certainly, if we're talking about, if we're talking about stress and depression, which are the, sort of the most common forms of psychopathology in a sense, and if it's in response to, say, financial difficulties, then certainly there are things people can do, and one of the first things people need to do is to acknowledge the nature of their problem. Too often people will, try to bury their heads in the sand or pretend that it's not really there or hope that it goes away in a sort of form of wishful thinking, and that's typically not very effective. Burying your head in the sand and pretending everything's fantastic when it's not typically doesn't work. And this is a really, really important point. Positive psychology and optimistic thinking are not about positive thinking. It's not about saying everything's fantastic if it's not. If you really are facing problems, as many people are, then we need to face up to those problems. We need to face them head off front on. We need to acknowledge them. But we want to acknowledge them in a constructive way. We want to start to look for solutions. This is what the happiest people do. So, again, they don't deny their problems. They face up to them, but they start to look for solutions as best they can. And that's one of the most important things we can do. We also need to recognize that we all need help at times. And so one of the most important things people can do during difficult times is not just sort of try and be strong. I guess if we can be strong, that's great, but to reach out and ask for help. And this is one of the most, this is one of the core pillars of resilience. People who are resilient tend to be good copers, but they also tend to be much better at reaching out and utilising their social support network. So, as well as looking for solutions and looking at your problem in an optimistic, constructive way, look at the people around you and ask yourself, who can help me? Where can I get the right support for me at this particular point in time? And at the end of the day, we've all got to do something. We need to take action. So too often people become sort of paralysed and overwhelmed by adversity, which is understandable, and we've probably all been there at some point in time. But if you can get up and do anything, if you can break the problem down into small achievable chunks, then even doing one thing, it might seem sort of small and insignificant, but if you can take one positive step today, engage in one constructive action, whether it might just be a phone call to a friend, it might be just jotting down some notes, whatever it might be, if you can engage in even a little bit of constructive action, then that tends to give us a sense of achievement, a sense of accomplishment, maybe a sense of pride. And as I said earlier, then positivity breeds positivity. That can, if we start to feel a little bit better, then we can see solutions more easily. And then if we start to see solutions more easily, we can see what to do. We can start to do a bit more. We can create a positive cycle, which, look, I know is easier said than done, and there are many times when it's very, very difficult. But looking at things in the best possible light, looking for solutions rather than getting bogged down the problem, reaching out and asking for help, taking some sort of constructive action, no matter how small it might seem, all of these things together are probably what I would recommend, depending on the sort of circumstances of the individual.
No, that's fantastic. Yeah, great, great tips there. What about using some, I mean, that's like key points there. That's fantastic. What about little things such as, you know, music as a tool? Has there been research done on, you know, the role of music or dance or that sort of area in terms of approaching it from a physical as well?
Well, what I should say, if we're going to focus on the physical, and I'm guessing that you know this as well as anyone, exercise is a powerful mood enhancer. Mm. Exercise is one of the most effective antidepressants we have. So yes, getting up and moving. And when I say exercise, I mean that in the broadest possible sense. Doesn't necessarily mean going to the gym or seeing a personal trainer. That's fine. I mean, that's great if you want to or can do that. But for some people that are very depressed, that can seem a bit too much. So even walking around the block, just doing anything, yes, movement, yes, can be very important because when we move, it gets all different. You know, it affects our physiology and all certain hormones and neurotransmitters are released. And as I said, we tend to feel a bit better and so we can be a bit more motivated then to go and do other things. So definitely any form of exercise, because walking can also be meditative and it can, you know, it can encourage reflection and contemplation. And so that can certainly be, I definitely encourage that, any form of exercise that you find enjoyable, given the circumstances. And yes, music, music and art and, well, anything that you think will enhance your mood a little bit. And certainly I know, personally, I find music a very powerful mood enhancer, and I, you know, music's a very important part of my life, and I know that not just when I'm feeling bad, but I use music all the time to feel good. I thoroughly enjoy listening to my, you know, favourite bands and my favourite CDs. So certainly, anything that will enhance your mood, whether it's music or art or talking to a friend or walking, or it is obviously a good thing. And they won't necessarily solve all of your problems. But what it can do is if it boosts your mood, even for just a few minutes, if you feel just that little bit better, then you're going to be more likely to take some constructive action that might then start to solve the problem. So even if it just gets the ball rolling, then yes, it's a great thing to do.
Yeah, and I do remember actually when I went through a bit of a period of depression a few years ago, and the thing that I hadn't noticed I did with music was, you know, when I was down, I tended to play depressing music. So it sort of sent me, and it wasn't until sort of someone pointed it out to me that I kind of realized that, you know, I was kind of setting myself into that spiral, and instead of using it as a positive tool, it was actually just sending me further and further down because I related to that negative space, you know. But then when I found someone pointed that out to me, it was very powerful to kind of just shift the music, as you say, and it just shifted the mood, even if only for a short time, just to remind me of that. So, yeah.
Definitely. Well, we see that. That's a classic sort of pattern we see in adolescents. Many adolescents who will lock themselves in the room and play, emo or sad, what's seemingly depressing music. But that's not always a bad thing. Yes, on the one hand, I would encourage people, as you hint at that, to try to play uplifting music. In this particular context, anyway, if we're looking to get ourselves going, then dare I say, happy music might be better than sad music. But what can be useful about sort of quote unquote depressing music is that sometimes it can make us feel that we're not on our own. You know, when we listen to some lyrics that someone might have written, and they, even if they're sort of sad and depressing, if we can relate to them, we can think, well, hey, this other person, you know, they're writing about what I'm feeling now. And if that can make us feel not alone, then that can actually be helpful. It can actually boost some mood, because one of the things about being particularly depressed is sometimes we do feel we're the only one in the world, no one else understands. But if we feel there is another person out there, this songwriter who does understand, that can actually be helpful. But probably as a general rule, I'd encourage people to try and tailor their music or select songs or albums that are more likely to make them feel better, as opposed to reinforce the sadness, which is probably not what we want.
Mm-hmm. And when you say, you know, this feeling of not being alone, what about the, you know, is important to and their sense of connection? What sort of research is there around that? You know, I've heard people say before, you know, getting a pet's a good idea and connection. What is the, you know, research around that? The benefits of, you know, the importance of connection, I guess.
Well, there's a lot. And in fact, Christopher Peterson, who I mentioned earlier, one of the grandfathers of positive psychology, was once asked several years ago at a conference, was once asked to sum up positive psychology. And normally, if you ask an academic a question like that, you'll get a 3-hour answer. But he actually said, I can do that in 3 words. He said, other people matter. And what we've seen over the last 10, 15 years is a growing, very strong, solid body of research that reinforces the fact that other people, the positive relationships, are potentially the most important contributor to our happiness. Now, we do need to look after ourselves. There's no doubt about it. I can't be happy if I'm literally sick and tired all the time. So I need to, I need to eat well and exercise and maybe meditate and think, good healthy thoughts, etc. But if that's all I do, then that can be selfishness. And real happiness is not selfishness. It's not hedonism. It is looking after myself, but then it's also connecting with others. It's also being a part of something else. So yes, there's a massive amount of research. In fact, my PhD research touched on this, that the relationships we have with others, the social support that's around us, is a key contributor to our health and well-being and happiness. And it works in at least two ways. One, it tends to boost our positive experiences. So we have, we're more likely to experience positive, to have positive experiences if we have positive relationships. But what it also does is buffer against stress and depression. People have good social support, are less likely to get sick and depressed, and if they do, they're more likely to bounce back more quickly. And this is actually what my PhD research looked at a couple of years ago now, that, again, those people that have good support networks, encouraging supportive spouses and partners, are far more likely to recover after physical injuries, for example, including negative cardiac events, heart attacks. So they recover more quickly, they need less medication, and they get back into life much faster than those people who don't have the same sort of support. So yes, it works on a number of levels. I mean, I guess in some ways the most important relationships are our intimate relationships, so there are husbands and wives and boyfriends and girlfriends, but then we obviously have our, we have our family, we have our friends, we have our colleagues, we have our community. And all of these different levels of relationships are all important. And so the more we spend time fostering and developing and reinforcing those sorts of relationships, the better for everyone involved. Really happy people, as I said, are not selfish. They're actually more generous and giving and more altruistic. So they spend more time doing nice things, good things to others. And then as a result, they tend to get more back. So it's a bit of a win-win. And it's one of the most important lessons we can all learn that, yes, although we need to look after ourselves, the more we look after others, the more we care for and do good things to and for others, the better for us as well.
Yeah, it's interesting because, yeah, often people say, the volunteer work helps them to get out of depression and stuff. So I guess, approaching it from an angle like that, you would recommend as well, possibly, depending on the situation.
I guess. Definitely. I mean, volunteering has innumerable benefits. Volunteering is it's a great thing to do, so that the person on the receiving end gets some sort of benefit, but the person who's giving gets a significant benefit as well. And there have even been studies where they've taken saliva samples and measured certain certain hormones and drugs within the body, and these can be enhanced when we volunteer. So there's a thing they sometimes refer to as the helper's high. People that help out, people that volunteer, actually get a physical and psychological high. And some of the hormones that are released during these types of activities will actually protect us against sickness. There are innumerable benefits that come from volunteering, from giving, from doing good for others, at all sorts of different levels. So it's one of the, if not the most important things we can do is to connect with others, build positive relationships. Being compassionate, being caring is one of the most fantastic things we can do for our happiness and health and well-being.
Yeah, fantastic. I've not heard of Helper's High. That's great. Interesting research. What about, so you've kind of crossed into now into the link with happiness and health. It sounds like there's been quite a lot of research in terms of, you were just speaking about the incidence of the recovery from heart attack and stuff being improved with greater connection and support and relationships. What other research have you found interesting in that area, or do you share on that level?
Look, I've always found that interesting. I spent most of my early career as a clinical psychologist working in pain management, people with chronic pain. That's the area I did my PhD research in. And I always thought it was interesting when people talked about this mind-body as though they were two separate things, and I could never understand why people separated them. For me, I mean, they're one and the same, or they're so highly integrated that it doesn't really make sense to me to differentiate. And by that I mean that, you know, what goes on in our mind, what we think about, all the psychological variables, what we think about, how we feel, affects our bodies, and vice versa. What we do with our bodies affects our mind. So I think the sooner we get away from those sorts of dichotomous models, the better for everyone. Because again, and this is where I sort of primarily learned about all this in the pain management area. There's no doubt that there's a physical component, but that's not everything. There's also no doubt that the way people think about the sensory experience is important. There's no doubt how they feel is important. And the support of the people around them is important. The context in which they are is important. So all of these variables contribute to the ultimate outcome, which is how well that person can or cannot function in their lives. And that's just one example. I mean, we see that generally. If we're looking at health and well-being, we need to sort of, I think we need to break down some of these barriers between different disciplines and recognize that the ultimate goal, which I would see is as many of us as possible living a thriving and flourishing life, the ultimate goal will come from contributions of physical factors or physical strategies like exercise, like diet and nutrition, and like even meditation. But then meditation crosses over, obviously, into the psychological. So, there are also significant contributions that come from the way we think about things, the way we interpret the world around us, the way we feel, etc., etc., and spiritual beliefs. So that crosses over again, and then we also get into these ideas of connectedness and relationships. So real health is not just a physical thing, it's not just a psychological thing, it's all of the above. And this is why, as I briefly touched on earlier, one of the most exciting areas that I'm working on at the moment is our new program called The Happiness Diet. Diet and weight loss is a very important area, and as I'm sure many of your listeners know, in many parts of the Western world we have far too many people that are far too overweight. Now, this isn't an aesthetic issue. We're not talking about beauty, or we're certainly not talking about looking like a fashion model, or that's actually potentially dangerous the other way. We don't want people to be too thin. But being overweight is unhealthy. You know, it's associated with all sorts of poor health outcomes like diabetes, et cetera, et cetera. So if we want as many people as possible to be as healthy as possible, we need to address all the various contributing factors, and for too long most diets or weight management programs have only focused on the physical, have only focused on exercise and nutrition. Now those things are very important, I'm not discounting them at all, but in addition we need to bring in some of these psychological variables, and that's what we've tried to do, and what I hope will actually enhance some of the efficacy that we get better, help people get better results. Because we've seen that just exercise and nutrition is probably not enough for a lot of people. It can work for some people, but there are many, many people whose health problems, including weight problems, are significantly tied into psychological issues. And if they're not addressed, then we're not going to get as good outcomes as we could do.
Yeah, no, it sounds fantastic. So how does the happiness diet work then exactly? Like, I mean, obviously not every detail, but what sort of approach is it people doing in that? Is it addressing it from the various approaches that you've mentioned, or is it, you know, is it more meditations, or is it, what sort of angle do you take with that?
Well, it's primarily a positive psychology program, and it was specifically designed to to target what I consider to be one of the problems in weight loss, which is the tyranny of when. Now, what I call the tyranny of when is when many people out there say something like, I'll be happy when. I'll be happy when I've lost 15 kilos. I'll be happy when I've dropped a few dress sizes. I'll be happy when whatever. Now, there's nothing wrong with setting goals, but what tends to happen then, if people say that sort of thing to themselves, I'll be happy when, then by definition, they're making themselves unhappy because they're not there yet. So they're deferring their happiness, and in fact, they're creating a sense of unhappiness, a dissatisfaction, a disappointment with their life. Now, what we know from the research, and in fact, what we know from common sense, is that things like dissatisfaction and disappointment are not motivating. If we're experiencing those sorts of negative emotions, and in the more extreme cases, depression, people actually lose motivation. So by slipping into this problem of the tyranny of when, people actually demotivate themselves, which means it's less likely they're going to do what they need to do to achieve their goals. And this is one of the reasons I think so many people fail with weight loss programs. So what we've done is turn that around, and the program is built on what I call the primacy of positivity. And this is about putting positivity first and foremost, rather than waiting until you've lost weight to be happy. What if we said, let's be happy first? Now, I'm not just talking about slapping on a fake smile or some sort of superficial happiness, but what the program is basically about is helping people to feel good about themselves and to feel good about their lives first and foremost. So we actually we take the pressure off the weight loss in a sense. We actually don't focus a lot on that in the early stages of the program. The early stages of the program are all about helping people focus on their strengths, reflect upon their successes in life, start to set some positive goals, and not just weight loss goals, but life goals. And what that does, and I'm going through this pretty quickly, of course, but what that does is quite simply make people feel better. And if they feel a bit better, if they feel more optimistic, more hopeful, then that is more motivating. People start to get energized again. They start to get inspired. And that then increases their chances of doing what they need to do. Now, they still need to go and do some exercise more often than not. They need to eat better. But they're more likely to do that if that positivity comes first and foremost. And this is what we're trying to do, create that great life first, build the positivity, and then make it much easier for our participants to do what they need to do to live a healthier life. And we also make sure that weight loss isn't the be-all and end-all, and I think that's where some diets go wrong. There's too much pressure on kilograms or kilojoules. Now, again, I'm not saying those things are unimportant, but our ultimate goal, the ultimate goal of the happiness diet, is to live a great life. And a healthy weight should, I think, only ever be part of that. It's an important part for some people, but we also get them to focus on other goals, other life goals, and the reason for that is, again, that they're what drive the motivation. Achieving great things in other parts of our lives makes us feel good about ourselves. If we feel good about ourselves, then we start to care about what we put in our mouth. And I think, again, too many weight loss programs have been too narrowly focused. And so we try to broaden the focus and really get people to think about what would a great life look like, not just what would a good weight look like. And we're getting, look, it's early days, but we're getting some really, really exciting, really, really good results. It's been very satisfying so far.
That sounds fantastic. It sounds like a program every gym in the world should be having. That's brilliant.
Sorry, but
really
it sounds like a program.
It sounds like the program that every gym in the world should be having. Having as part of their system.
Right.
I mean, it's as you say. You know, without the level of happiness, the motivation isn't there. And also, yeah, it's sort of once you're happy, there's the choices in our own minds. You know, from my experience, seem so easy to achieve. Like I just love that approach. It sounds like a brilliant program, and it's an online program. Is that correct?
It is, and yeah, so that's, and so what we've also done, so it's online, we wanted to make it as accessible as possible, and what we've also tried to do, what we have done, is build in some social network type strategies, so we've kind of modelled some aspect on a little bit like a Facebook type context, but by that we mean, so people can do it on their own, there is an individual version, but we actually encourage people to do it either with a buddy or in a group. And that's because, and we talked a bit earlier about positive relationships and positive support, and the research clearly suggests that people that engage in these sorts of healthy programs with a buddy or in a group are more likely to succeed if they've got that positive support. So what people can do when they sign up, they'll be automatically assigned to a group depending on when they sign up. And they support each other. And it really is fantastic. I obviously monitor that, and we have a team that monitor it. But more often than not, I find myself looking at the comments that people make to and about each other. And I just sit back and say, hey, I don't really have to do anything here. It does include professional support, psychological support, but often the support they get from each other, that positive peer support, is very, very powerful. And it's just, the series has been fantastic to see them hold each other's hands, pick each other up when they have a bad week, and they'll pick each other up and encourage each other and, come on, you can get back on the track and all that sort of stuff. So we've built that social support into the program. So anyone, anywhere can do this. Anyone can support the other people within their group. And, I agree. I mean, I'd love to see, we'd love to be partnering up with gyms and other weight loss approaches, because I should acknowledge we don't claim necessarily to have all the answers. It is primarily a psychological program, so we don't have a lot of specific expert advice on nutrition or exercise. There's some basic stuff there, but we'd love to partner up with someone who, some organisations who offer more expertise in those other areas, because then we get an even more powerful approach. And we're having a few conversations with a few people about that. But yeah, we'd love to see it in every gym as well.
No, I think so. Yeah, we'll chat. We'll spread that word. I think. I mean, it sounds like something that has been lacking in so many programs, as you say, and such an important part to enable all the other. And there's no use having the other expertise without having the mindset for doing it. I think that's really exciting especially for in my industry. I'm really excited to hear that it's out there, and hopefully, by the end of the year, it'll be better known everywhere. It sounds brilliant. And so people can connect, how are their groups actually established? Is that they are linked up with people in similar areas, or can you be with someone sort of on the other side of the world type of thing?
No, well, basically, we looked at all sorts of options and weighed up a whole bunch of variables, including sort of clinical factors, but ultimately also pragmatic, practical ones. And what it comes down to now, if you go into the buddy program, then you actually sign up with a friend. So that will typically be someone you know. And we've actually had a few mums and daughters and husbands and wives. But more often than not, you and a good friend who's, wants to go through the same journey with you. But if it's the group program, then it's basically just a timing thing. If you sign up today, for example, then it'll basically just be the next 10 people. So we've limited the groups to, I think it's 10, it might be 12 actually, I'm not sure. But we've limited the groups to a reasonable size. So, we thought of hundreds of people, because then you wouldn't get to know anyone. So basically, if you sign up today, then the next 10 people will just automatically be put into a group. Or if there aren't 10 people that sign up, then we didn't want people to wait around for weeks and weeks. So at the end of a certain period of time, that group will just automatically be formed, even if there's only 4 or 7 people. But those people could be anywhere around the world. And we figured that didn't really matter that much. We thought that what was more important was having like-minded people supporting each other, rather than, we didn't really think geography would necessarily be that important. And also we thought, if we were going to wait for 10 people just in Sydney or just in London or whatever it might be, it might take a bit longer for that group to fill up. And we wanted, if people sign up today, we want them to get started as soon as possible. So there's primarily practical factors determined that. If you're in the buddy program, then you are with a friend that you've selected. If you're in the group program, then it'll pretty much be a random collection. But what we've found is, again, that by definition, the people that sign up to this program are pretty much like-minded people with, who are ready and willing and interested in taking this particular approach. And so they've been very, very supportive of each other so far.
Oh, that's fantastic. You're on the Health and Happiness Show on Untangled FM. I'm Edwina Griffin speaking with Dr. Timothy Sharp. And so the website with the happiness diet is thehappinessdiet.com.au, is that correct?
Yes, that should. Yeah, that'll take them there. And there's hopefully there's enough information on the site for them to explain things. So it has a bit of a brief overview, and we've tried to design it to be pretty easy to use, which more often than not, you know, most people, sometimes they're, you know, just a little bit tech savvy. But yeah, it's a pretty simple explanation and sign up process. If they've got any questions, they can get in touch with us. But there's also, we've also got an attached Facebook page that people can go to, or the happinessinstitute.com general website. They can also get in touch with us there and find out a bit more information if they want.
Yeah. Well, I'll give your contact details again at the end. Because I've got a couple more questions I want to ask you, if I may.
Yes.
I just wanted to ask about, you know, in terms of happiness, there's a couple of other things around that. In that often we're focusing on, you know, the way we think and the way we feel. What about the power of words and language on our subconscious? How do you see that in terms of its importance?
Oh, look, personally, I said it's very important, but professionally, yes, there's no doubt at all. I mean, there are, primarily my background training was in what we call cognitive therapy or cognitive behaviour therapy, which, as you just sort of hinted at, is a lot about what we say to ourselves, the content of our thoughts, our beliefs, our expectations, our attitudes, all of that. But there are a number of similar sorts of approaches, including narrative therapy, which focus on the importance of the stories that we tell ourselves, the language that goes into those stories. So I think that's very, very important. A lot of people discount some of the things they say to themselves and say, oh, I didn't really mean it. But if you're saying something to yourself over and over again, then it does have an impact, whether you like it or not, whether you realize it or not. And so I'm actually quite pedantic, and in fact, I was working with a client just the other day, and she was laughing at me because I kept picking her up on certain things she said to herself. And she was saying, oh, it's not really that important. But I was picking her up because I was trying to get her to understand that it is important. The language we use, what we say to ourselves, has a significant impact on how we feel about ourselves, how we feel about the world around us, and on our lives generally. So this is one of the most important things that I think we all can do, and what, you know, as a therapist and a coach, what I'm more often than not helping my clients to do is to firstly just become aware of that, because most of us aren't even aware of that language we use. So one of the first things I hope people do is to try and become aware, to stop and think about their thoughts, to think about the language that they're using, because those things are important. And if they're negative or unhelpful in some way, we need to change them, but we can't change them if we don't even know what they are in the first place. So the first step of what we might call mindfulness or awareness or whatever you want to call it, but by increasing our awareness into our thoughts and the language and what we say to ourselves, the stories we tell ourselves, that's the first step in starting to maybe develop more helpful language that will lead to us feeling better and getting on and living a more successful life.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And one other thing I saw on your website, which I did want to ask you about, was you were referring to some research on balanced time perspective, versus, you know, what I've always heard about associated with happiness, which is, you know, this living in the present. What is your opinion on this in terms of, you know, it's sort of discussed on your site, about whether we should be living in all time periods, the past, present and future, versus just living in the present?
Yeah, look, that article that you referred to is a very interesting one, and it's quite a sort of hot topic right at the moment. And you're right. I mean, I think for many, many years, or for many hundreds of years, there has been this focus. And I've said this often myself as well, but, you know, the only time we can really be happy is the present moment. And obviously there are a lot of a lot of ancient approaches that have focused on that. Buddhism obviously has a big emphasis on it, as do many other sort of philosophies and religions. And look, I think that is important. I do think that many of us, well, there is no doubt that the research suggests many of us could benefit from spending more of our time focusing on living in and enjoying the present moment. However, what this new research is suggesting, that yes, that probably, that almost certainly is important, but we also need to probably balance that with some other time perspectives, so to speak, so that we can also gain happiness from positively reflecting on the past, positively reminiscing. And we kind of all do this in a way. When we think back on you know, that great holiday we had a few years ago, or a wedding, or the birth of a child, or even a birthday party, or some great social event, or whatever it might be, you know, a great achievement that we had. When we think back on those moments, we do get a form of happiness. And that's important. We can leverage off that. So in addition to living in and enjoying the moment, we can positively reminisce about the past, and we can also plan for the future. And this brings a slightly different form of happiness. So when we look forward to a holiday, when we visualize our goals and imagine ourselves achieving some great things in the future, that brings with it a sense of excitement and joy as well. And I think what just to sum up, what this research is suggesting is that really the happiest people, or the best way to be happy, is to learn to move fluidly through these different time frames. And I guess the question that we can all ask ourselves is, what's the best thing for me to focus on right now? Should I be in the moment, or would it be beneficial to reflect upon the past or look forward to the future? There's no simple right or wrong answer, or the answer would differ for different people at different times. But if we can ask ourselves those sorts of questions and sometimes reflect on the past, sometimes look forward to the future, sometimes be in the moment, if we get that balance right, then that's a fantastic outcome. And it's something we could probably all give a bit more thought to.
Mm. Yeah, I guess, I mean, that's the thing I love with my vision board and things like that. It's often good when you're having a hard time. It's like, I'll look at my vision board and get excited again. And I was kind of excited to read that research because it's sort of, like you say, you know, being in the present moment, so much benefit. But I always had that conflict in me of, well, hold on, I do love looking at my vision board. So there's got to be a role for that. So it kind of puts a place with it all in my head and an understanding of where it fits. So thanks for
explaining. Well, definitely,
so
vision board's so a vision board is a great example of future thinking, and there's no doubt that can be very helpful and positive for other people. But if that's all we do, look at this and think about this vision board, we probably won't ever get there, because at some point in time we've got to do something. We've got to take some constructive action to make that a reality.
Yeah.
So when do we do that? Well, the only time we can actually take constructive action is now. So to make our vision board a reality, we want to focus on that and use the motivation that comes from that, but we need to take action in the present moment. Now, the other thing that we can do, if we've got to take action in the present moment, is to reflect on the past and learn lessons, you know, what's helped me in the past. So that's actually a great example. If we get that balance right of learning lessons from the past to do stuff in the moment to take us forward, then that's, you know, that's success and happiness. So, and that's, again, that's the point of this particular research, is getting that balance right. It's not about being all in the future or all in the past or all in the moment. They all have a role to play. But we've just got to, you know, again, we've got to get the balance right. And if we do that, it's going to be amazingly powerful.
Yeah. Well, it looks like we're kind of out of time. I feel like I could talk to you all day, Tim. Thank you so much. I'm going to go check out your happiness diet. That sounds brilliant. So, again, I just want to give listeners your contact details. Your main website would be the Happiness Institute or Dr. Happy, which is your seminary option.
Well, if they want to find out, so a bit about me personally, they can go to Dr. Happy, drhappy.com.au. That's sort of my personal site. That'll actually have links to the other site, so that from there they can get to thehappinessinstitute.com. And also thehappinessdiet.com.au. But if they go to drhappy.com.au, there are links to all the other ones, including our Facebook and Twitter activities as well.
Okay, thank you so much. So for listeners, Dr. Timothy Sharp, a fantastic chat today. So many insights on happiness. I'll be listening to the interview again. And thanks again for being with us. Next week, I will be speaking to an expert about how to use running to boost your level of health and happiness. Thank you for joining us, and I'll speak to you next week.